Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. In any long-term relationship, partners are bound to change over time. You either grow closer or further apart. But what if that change were out of your control entirely, and growing apart became inevitable? These are questions Robert St. Amant didn't think too much about until he was forced to. Peter Gallagher, known for shows like Law & Order SVU, Grace and Frankie, and The OC, reads Robert's essay, Promises That Can Bend Without Breaking.
In December, my wife and I moved out of our house into an independent living apartment. Walking through the building, you might take it for a well-kept hotel, until you notice the handrails lining the hallways, the nursing assistants in the common areas, and the people pushing walkers in front of them rather than pulling luggage carts behind them. The average resident is close to 80 years old. The end of the year brought a stream of visitors. One afternoon, we joined the other residents to meet with fourth graders, who shyly handed us candy canes and Christmas cards they had made. A quartet of a cellist and three violinists, their instruments marked with colored tape to help with the fingering, played for us on another day. In the common dining room, with chairs and tables pushed out of the way, we have watched young ballet students dancing parts of the Nutcracker. We have listened to a teenage harpist and sung Christmas carols accompanied by a visiting pianist. I'm not sure I belong here. You'll occasionally hear others say the same thing, but it's different for me. I'm in good health, physically and mentally, and I work full time. I just turned 50. My wife, a year younger, is the reason we're here. We've been married 28 years, most of them carefree, some even exciting. In our first year together, we were living in Texas. I found out about a job opening at a satellite office of the company I worked for. I called my wife on the phone. "What would you think of moving to Germany?" I asked. "Sure," she said. 6 weeks later, we walked into a small apartment in Moosburg, a small town just outside Munich. We spent the next 5 years in Germany exploring Europe during weekends and holidays. We discovered we were within a day's drive of Paris, Amsterdam, Berlin, and Vienna, and we made those trips. The evening before my birthday 1 year, my wife met me in the Munich train station on my return from a business trip. She pulled two suitcases from a locker and told me we were booked on a night train to Florence. Sometimes we'd take long driving trips through the countryside, my wife navigating with a map. We had no destination in mind, but it was good to know where we were, if not where we were going. We'd eventually happen upon a small village with a guest house, perhaps on a picturesque town square, for food and drink and lodging. Our lives were open-ended. Eventually, we moved back to the United States. I went to graduate school in Massachusetts, earned a PhD in computer science, and landed a job as a university professor in North Carolina. We bought a house with a swimming pool on the outskirts of Raleigh. My wife found her calling in the craft of weaving. She'd occasionally sell a scarf or table runner on consignment, and once she saw her work appear in a national weaving magazine. The wanderlust struck us now and then. We spent my sabbatical year living in Southern California and talked about the possibility of moving back to Europe at some point. But we had settled down. On a summer afternoon almost 7 years ago, we were in the swimming pool. It was my wife's 43rd birthday, and we were talking about where we'd go to dinner when she became quiet for a while. She slid off her float into the water, face down, and didn't come up for air. I pulled her out of the pool and called 911. A few hours later in the emergency room, a doctor told me my wife had had a seizure caused by brain tumors. Late that night, my wife had regained consciousness in her hospital room. She could speak, and she even smiled. A neurosurgeon talked with both of us, though he said that my wife was heavily medicated and wouldn't remember our conversation later. The MRI showed 3 meningiomas, tumors in the membrane surrounding the brain. The doctor described them being the sizes of a walnut, a cherry, and a plum. They would need to be removed by surgery. "What will you put in their place?" my wife asked. "Nothing," he said. "The brain and its fluids will expand to fill the space." "Will I be smarter then?" The doctor and I laughed, while my wife just looked puzzled. It was a rare, bright moment in the neurological intensive care unit. The tumors were benign. After 2 surgeries and a painful recovery, it seemed that life might return to normal. She and I talked about the future, what we would do with our lives. We no longer had forever. My wife went back to work 2 or 3 days a week, but devoted most of her free time to her crafts of weaving and embroidery. I had never stopped working. In my spare time, I wrote a science book, and my wife gave it a fitting title, Computing for Ordinary Mortals. We still traveled. We visited friends and family in other states, and we spent a summer month on the island of Madeira. "This would be a good place for us," my wife said. I agreed. I talked with a friend at the University of Madeira about job possibilities. But on an annual checkup, my wife's MRI showed new brain tumors. This time the treatment was radiation, and she never fully recovered. She became absent-minded, sometimes searching for ordinary words, glass, broom, table, for up to a minute in conversation. She lost track of time. She began to fall down. "When are we going home?" she'd ask. And I'd walk around the room to point out the lamp she'd brought back from Venice, the antique floor loom in the corner, and her fabrics hanging on the walls. We were already home. By fall of last year, her dementia was comparable to mid-stage Alzheimer's disease. Neurologists and neurosurgeons ran tests and suggested treatments to no effect. On our last visit several months ago, her neurologist said it would be surprising to see any improvement over time. We talked then, while my wife still had lucid periods. In the past, we'd had fun with idle questions about the future. If we could live anywhere in the world, where would it be? Or what would we do with $1 million? This time, it was more serious. What will we do if you don't remember who I am? We agreed that staying together was the most important thing, in sickness and in health, after all. The solution seemed to be a place that caters to people with my wife's condition. The apartment is as familiar as I can make it. Our furniture is arranged to match our old house. Sometimes we sit in the living room and look through our photo albums. I bring out examples of my wife's weaving and embroidery for her to turn over in her hands. One sunny day, we were walking outside after lunch. In the parking lot, we passed by a small blue convertible. "That's a nice car," my wife said. Occasionally, she speaks without prompting, but that's becoming rare. "It is," I said. "What do you like about it?" "It's a pretty color." "Would you like to go for a ride?" "Sure." We walked to the passenger door and I opened it. She looked confused. "Is this our car?"
"Yes."
My wife had arranged for us to buy the car from one of her friends 6 months earlier. "It's okay," I said. "We haven't had it for long."
"I thought you were joking," she said. "I thought you were joking. Do you want to go somewhere?"
"No." Sometimes I think about the vows my wife and I made to each other 28 years ago, and then again last summer. We're different people than we once were. Does that make breaking a promise easier? Last summer I said, "You can trust me. I'll always tell you the truth about what's happening." Today, I tell her small, comforting lies. Some promises, though, aren't just things you say or intend to do. They're about what kind of person you are. That makes it easier to decide what's right. My wife and I were recently sitting with a group of older women, drinking coffee. One leaned over to me and whispered, "Are you the son?" I corrected her impression, which may have been due to failing eyesight. "No, we're married." I was surprised at the question. When I look at my wife, I still see the lovely younger woman in our photos and in my memory. Sometimes she looks back at me and smiles. Even though she may not know who I am.
Peter Gallagher, reading Robert St. Amant's essay, Promises That Can Bend Without Breaking. We'll find out how Rob and his wife are doing today after the break. We're back. It's Modern Love, the podcast. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's been 3 years since Robert St. Amant's essay was published. Just a few months after he wrote it, he and his wife moved back into their home in Raleigh. We were in touch with Rob in January of 2016, and we asked him what he thought of the promise couples make to stay together in sickness and in health.
I'll be honest, I don't think it's a realistic one in all situations. We think, sometimes two people have made the wrong decision, or sometimes two people grow apart. I think what's happening with me and my wife, I'll always make sure she's taken care of. But sometimes that growing apart happens much more suddenly and drastically than you expect.
6 months after that conversation, Rob made a difficult decision. He decided to move his wife into an assisted living facility. He wrote us this email shortly thereafter. 6 weeks after the move, there's a good deal of guilt, even though I think I chose the least bad option and would do it again. The house is empty, but it's full of reminders of my wife. So many of my habits and routines are no longer needed. I don't have to come home from work at a specific time so that the professional caregiver can leave. I don't have to set aside an hour in the morning and in the evening to help my wife start or end her day, and so forth. I'm torn inside, trying to balance what I think my wife would have wanted as she used to be and what she wants or needs now as a very different person. How do I choose for her, with our marriage having turned from a partnership into a guardianship? We heard from Rob again this past March. Here's what he wrote. My wife is doing well in the assisted living facility. I admire the people who care for her now, especially knowing how difficult it is. I'd thought that with the passage of time, I'd have a better understanding of dementia, of my wife's condition, and of our relationship. But I'm still adjusting. I can imagine myself saying, I'm adjusting a year from now. I might keep repeating this for the rest of my life. I suppose that's the nature of things. We got one more update from Rob just last week. He and his wife celebrated her birthday with one of their old rituals. They arranged flowers. I bring flowers, Rob wrote, as colorful and pretty a bunch as I can find at our local supermarket. I prop up a vase in my wife's lap. I hand her a daisy or a carnation or a rose after I've cut the stem. On a good day, she'll grasp the flower and put it in the vase. On other days, I'll guide her hand. I say, these flowers are just for you. Aren't they beautiful? Sometimes she agrees. Yes. Robert St. Amant. He's a computer science professor at North Carolina State University. Coming up, Dan Jones on why Rob's essay felt deeply personal to him. We can't always imagine ourselves in the situations that these modern love essays bring to light. But Daniel Jones, editor of the column for the New York Times, says Rob's essay immediately felt all too real.
I'm the same age as he is, and my wife is pretty much the same age as his wife. It just put that question straight at me, where I think I'm in the prime of my life and my wife is too. And what would happen if I were the one who slipped off into that pool, or if she were the one who slipped off into that pool, and we were still going to live for another 30 or 40 years? And the way Robert just spells this out, it's just really effective and sort of a challenge to the listener or the reader to say, like, how would you handle this? And you might want to think about it, because it's not an isolated event.
Thanks to Peter Gallagher for reading Rob's essay. You can see him in the Netflix series Grace and Frankie and in the film A Bad Mom's Christmas. It's in theaters in November. Modern Love is a production of the New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Jessica Alpert, John Parati, Amory Sievertson, and Caitlin O'Keefe. Additional sound design by Matt Reed. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for the New York Times and advisor to the show. Music for the podcast, courtesy of APM. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We'll see you next week.